This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and our top story today, as it has been pretty much every day over the last year, is the coronavirus. We're going to spend some time looking at how two of Boston's iconic institutions have fared 1 year into the pandemic. We begin with a one-year checkup from Massachusetts General Hospital. To help us with that is Dr. Peter Slavin, president of Mass General. Dr. Slavin, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much. Good to be back.
So earlier this week, the Commonwealth marked the one-year anniversary of the first confirmed COVID case. I want to know, do you remember hearing about that first case, and what did you think at that time?
I heard back in January from some of our infectious disease and emergency preparedness staff that they had become aware of this virus in China and were concerned about the potential that it had. And so we actually started our emergency planning activities back then and then turned them on in earnest later that month when it became clear that the virus had spread out of China and was likely going to be in the Boston area before too long.
So you were really treating it as it's a matter of time. We've got a switch. We're ready to flip. And you actually flipped the switch, it sounds like, before the first case was confirmed here in the Commonwealth.
That's correct. And it's hard to believe that we've last week celebrated our one-year anniversary of our emergency preparedness command center. Normally under, when we deal with emergencies, be they marathon bombings or nightclub fires, we are in this mode for a few days, but to be in it for a year has been an extraordinary thing to watch.
That sounds exhausting. Can you try to help us understand what the hospital, your staff, the patients have been through in this past year?
I mean, certainly one of the most inspirational parts of this for me has just been to see how our staff has responded. I think early on, they were a little bit excited about being right on the front lines of perhaps our nation's biggest problem in our generation. But I think over time, that excitement sort of wore out. And the fear, the exhaustion associated with caring for patients with this pandemic took over. I'm pleased to say that I think the staff is in good shape. Some of them clearly have been traumatized by what they went through, particularly in the spring. This year, I mean, in the last few months, as we've seen another surge, fortunately much smaller than the one we saw last spring. I think, and our staff knows much better how to care for these patients. They become reasonably routine. I think the staff is much more relaxed and it feels much more like business as usual at the hospital.
Was there for you ever a moment when you thought, oh, this is going to be too much. We will not keep up. We are going to be overrun.
Yeah, when the numbers in the spring kept climbing and we got up as high as 400 inpatients with COVID-19 and almost 200 of whom were in our intensive care units. I mean, we had developed plans to be able to care for more patients, maybe as many as 300 ICU patients, but we just didn't know when the numbers were going to start to turn in the right direction. And so there was some fear that they would exceed our ability to care for patients. And I guess using a nautical analogy, that the sea would breach the sea wall. Fortunately, that didn't happen. The numbers started heading back in the right direction. We had a bit of a respite over the summer when the numbers were really small. And then they've come back, in the case of Mass General, to about a third of what they were last spring.
Dr. Slavin, what about patient care? As a layperson, it seems that a year ago we really didn't know how to respond to COVID-19, especially as severe cases started to emerge. Is patient treatment substantially different now? And has it gotten better? Has it stayed largely the same?
Yeah, well, caring for patients with any disease, I mean, there's a certain rhythm to it. You sort of know the moves that the disease makes and can respond to them. Early on, we didn't really know the moves of this particular disease. And so every case was a bit of an adventure. And obviously, since that time, we've also had some therapeutics that have come into the marketplace that seem to make a difference for people in various stages of illness, be they monoclonal antibodies, remdesivir, steroids. There's no doubt that those individually and sometimes in combination can help as well.
Any game changers among that list, Dr. Slavin? One that once you were finally able to use it with patients, you were like, okay, now, you know, now we've really got something here.
I think probably the biggest game changer has been the steroids, dexamethasone, a medicine that's been with us for a number of years. I remember using it when I was a resident at Mass General. More recently, there's been some very positive data about some of the monoclonal antibodies suggesting that they can reduce hospitalization rates and also reduce deaths among outpatients with COVID-19. So those studies have just recently come out, and so I have my fingers crossed that those antibodies will be even more of a significant weapon against this disease than we initially thought.
So, that kind of makes me want to transition to vaccinations. And I think the way I'll do that is I'll ask you, we talked to the developer of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine at the beginning of the week, Dr. Dan Baruch, and they started working on a vaccine really in late January. Did we as a medical community get the balance right between pursuing a vaccine and pursuing treatments in those early months of of the pandemic?
I mean, I think we did. In addition to the heroism of healthcare workers this past year, one of the other inspirational things for me has just been to see the power of modern medical science and the way the scientific community has pivoted to address COVID-19. I mean, we now have less, just a little more than a year after we became aware of this disease, two vaccines that we're actively using. Hopefully, the Johnson and Johnson vaccine that Dr. Baruch was behind will get approved by the FDA in the coming days. And so that gives us a lot of hope for the future. I think therapeutics are actually harder to develop than vaccines, particularly against viruses. There are a number of candidates, well, number of some drugs that have already come on the market, other candidates being tested, but I don't think it's any surprise that their impact on the disease is probably in the long run going to be less than that of vaccines.
So let's stay with vaccines. I'm sure you're aware that Governor Baker says that the Commonwealth started with a slow, targeted rollout so that we could get to some very specific vulnerable populations. Do you believe that was the right strategy at the beginning?
I've been on regular phone calls with Governor Baker, Secretary Sutters, and have just been continuously impressed at how thoughtfully they've approached this pandemic. I think it's a result of recommendations coming out of the National Academy. Massachusetts initially decided to vaccinate healthcare workers and first responders, and then turned its attention to the general population. And I'm thrilled that at Mass General and across our health system, Mass General Brigham, and across the state, we've begun vaccinating people over the age of 75. I think some other states have taken a more helter-skelter, less focused approach to vaccination, but I think this is probably the right one, and I think it's recently entered a new phase that we're extremely excited about.
Has Mass General vaccinated its entire staff at this point, or most of the staff?
We've offered it to our entire staff. I think somewhere over 80% of the staff have been vaccinated with at least one dose, and there are a number of people who were scheduled for their second dose. So the vast majority of our staff has taken the vaccine.
And was that the decision to offer it to everyone? Was that a hospital decision, or was that direction that you received from the Commonwealth?
No, we abide by the Commonwealth's direction. One of our physicians, Dr. Bittinger, is chairing the committee at the state level that's advising the administration on vaccine deployment. So we have input into the state's priorities, but once those priorities and rules are set, we're obliged to follow them.
So I'm sure you're aware that there's been some discussion about that. And in a story about who and hospitals are getting vaccinated, Michael Mina, who's a professor at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health, told NPR, quote, "We're seeing just a huge number of people get vaccinated, who I think should frankly be way down the line. These are people who have nothing to do at all with COVID or with patient care or really with the hospitals," end quote. I want to ask you, do you understand where that criticism and concern comes from, and how do you respond to it? I'm sure you've heard this as the head of Mass General.
No, I have heard that criticism, and I understand it. Whenever you have a resource that everybody in our society desperately wants, and you only have a limited amount of it, there inevitably are going to be unhappy people until much further along in the rollout. I think the rationale for the decision to go forward with healthcare workers was just to make sure that we had the workforce on hand necessary to care for everyone else. And yes, there are people who, in their day-to-day job, may be working in a research laboratory at Mass General, but during the first wave, and even to some degree during this wave, we've redeployed that staff so that they are helping with various patient care activities, be it registering patients for their vaccination, be it keeping an eye on monitors for our busy clinical staff in our intensive care unit. So we've redeployed many people within our staff to help out with this epidemic.
So you said about 80% of the staff that you've invited to be vaccinated have been. I don't know if this is the right way to think about it, but in fact, I'm guessing it's not. But does that help you achieve some kind of herd immunity inside the hospital network? Or do you feel an urgency that you hope to convince the rest of the staff to be vaccinated? How are you thinking about that?
Yeah, we want everybody ultimately to get vaccinated, but we're not forcing it, unlike with influenza, just because these vaccines are being issued under an emergency authorization. So we think people should have the right to decide whether to get it or not. Yeah, certainly having everybody in the hospital vaccinated will help, but those same people are going home, going into the community, and so it doesn't really provide herd immunity for our entire community, but it certainly keeps a higher percentage of them well and able to care for others.
And do you know, at the hospital, do you know in advance how many doses you are getting? And have you had to hold any doses back due to the phasing? We know the Commonwealth has distributed only about 60% of the doses it has received.
Yeah, I mean, clearly there is, I think there's been greater clarity in the last few weeks about the vaccine pipeline, but it still has to go from the manufacturers to the federal government to the states, and then distributed by the states to hospitals, pharmacies, large vaccination centers. So that process is pretty cumbersome from beginning to end. My understanding is that the way it's working now is that we're going to be told every Friday how much vaccine to expect for the following week, starting on Wednesday. And so we'll be able to flex up or down our vaccination capacity based on the allotment we'll be getting from the state. But the amount of vaccine relative to the demand is still small. We have across our health system, Mass General Brigham, 150,000 patients over the age of 75 who are eligible for vaccine. And this past week, we were told by the state that we were getting 10,000 vaccine doses. Mm-hmm. So we have a lot of very disappointed patients over the age of 75 who we can't help this week and who are scrambling to find other vaccination opportunities in the community.
So Dr. Slavin, briefly before we let you go, where are you feeling the greatest sense of urgency right now?
Clearly the greatest focus at the moment has been on vaccination and trying to get that out as quickly as possible and as equitably as possible. I guess the other thing that's lurking in my mind are these variants and how much of a setback they're going to cause us in the long term. This virus clearly is able to mutate as most viruses can. So far, despite its mutations, it seems to still be vulnerable to vaccines and therapeutics. But I guess that's my greatest concern. It does, in general, look like we're heading down, we're over the hump and maybe heading down the slope to the finish line. But certainly a variant could emerge that could dash those hopes. I certainly hope not.
And that is Dr. Peter Slavin, president of Massachusetts General Hospital. Dr. Slavin, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Take care.
The Museum of Fine Arts had to close a second time in late December as Boston's COVID cases surged and the city issued new restrictions. Well, they reopened today at 25% capacity, and the director of the MFA, Matthew Teitelbaum, is with us. Matthew, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much.
So last time we spoke, it was September, and the MFA was preparing to reopen after restrictions. You had to close again. Tell us about the impact of this latest closure on staff, morale, your finances.
Well, we closed just before Christmas, and today we're actually reopening. So, you know, we were closed for that period of time, 43 days, and it was challenging because one of the realities about this moment is you don't know what the end looks like. You don't know when it's going to come. and you don't know what it looks like. So when we closed on December 23rd, there was a lot of uncertainty. Now, we kept all the staff in place. You know, we kept things going because there was still work in the museum to do. But we were close to the public. And, you know, let's face it, we exist to serve our public. We exist to create public, to bring people together. So there was a real sense of loss. I want to be clear that I support completely whatever decision was made to deal with the public health crisis. That's not my point is that the museum exists to create a sense of community, a sense of pleasure, a sense of connectedness, and we all felt that we lost that.
So what's the feeling there today?
Pretty buoyant. I was there when we opened, down at the front doors. Slow beginning. It's been really picking up. I mean, lots and lots of people this afternoon. To the extent that we have capacity, we're meeting capacity. We reopened with a couple new areas open again, so our Asian galleries and some pretty spectacular new Egyptian galleries that opened, and people who came in wanted to see those. So that was really gratifying to me that, yes, we have Basquiat, yes, we have Monet. People want to see those two special exhibitions, but the collection itself was really a draw, was really appealing. And the reason that's important to me is it tells me that people feel connected to something that's in their community. The collection belongs to them, the collection serves them, and people want to be part of it. That was very exciting to see, and people came in with real excitement.
Any particular piece of art that you or colleagues or members of the public seek out for comfort or inspiration in a moment like this?
Well, you know, I think comfort and inspiration. You know, we have two special exhibitions on at the moment. One, a 42 Monet paintings, 37 of which are in our collection, and then another extraordinary exhibition of the work of a great contemporary artist, Jean-Michel Basquiat, and his colleagues, his peers from early 1980s New York. And they give comfort. They give comfort because they affirm, and they are inspirational, and they inspire new ways of thinking, both of them. So we're doing really well with both. People are responding, and I think it is for those reasons that you're describing. People do feel a sense of comfort in being with beautiful works of art, being with works of art that engage them, being with works of art that take them beyond themselves, and both of these exhibitions are doing just that for our visitors.
You mentioned operating at reduced capacity. You're at 25%. You know, looking for a silver lining. Is there something special about encountering the art in the MFA with fewer people around?
You know, I think there, I mean, I don't mean to be light about this in any way and take away from people's, the real anxiety people are living with. But there are many silver linings, and one of them in the context of reduced capacity is exactly what you're saying. People are having really great experiences with works of art. They're seeing them as if they're in their living rooms. They're able to go more slowly through the museum and therefore take them in. I was walking through the galleries just after 10 this morning, and there was a single woman in one of the galleries with our French Impressionist paintings, and I said, this feels pretty good, doesn't it? And she, beyond her mask, through her mask, had this huge smile, and she said, it sure does. And so just what you're saying, there is a sense of real, you know, we're lucky. We're having this moment, and we're able to have it in real peace and quiet. There's something exciting about that.
Matthew, you've talked repeatedly already today about forming public, being community, and you've been in a sustained conversation with us for a couple of years now about the need for the MFA to belong to more people in Boston, to be responsive to, listen to more people in Boston. How are you doing that through this pandemic, and are you seeing a difference in who feels comfortable and welcome in the museum?
You know, I do think we're seeing a perceptible difference. I think people are coming back to the museum because they do feel that it's comfortable and safe. I think people are coming back because they're finding meaning here. And we do have a variety of special programs, particularly around art, that are different than they've been before. And they run the full range. So just think about Claude Monet, one of the greatest 19th century artists, you know, whose work celebrates the beauty of the landscape. At the same time, Jean-Michel Basquiat, urgent urban artist, talking about the beauty of community and of being recognized by your peers creating your own sense of belonging. You know, I think that great artists give us pleasure, and they empower us. They give us pleasure because there's something that slows us down. We look at beauty. We reflect on something that an artist has done that's at a very high plane. But they also empower us to think differently about ourselves in relation to others, ideas that maybe push us out of our comfort zone. I think museums do the same. I think they give great pleasure, and they empower us. And I think that's what's happening at the moment with the programming that the curators and other creative types at the museum are creating for our publics. We are giving great pleasure. I mean, that Monet show is just filled with the most rapturous moments of reflection and thoughtfulness about a time that seems past. But the Basquiat show is also filled with pleasure, that notion of assertion about being creative yourself and being identified by others. And both also empower, because Monet helped us to see the world differently through the lens of science and the impressions of the eye. And Basquiat helps us think about our own voice as individuals and how we deserve to be heard. So, again, it's this pleasure empowerment dialogue which I think brings museums alive. And I think we are becoming more and more of that. And I don't think you can be something in the future if you forget the past. And I think that we're doing a pretty good job of balancing the two.
Matthew, are you seeing new visitors of color, new visitors from historically marginalized neighborhoods in Boston?
I wouldn't want to quantify it, but my answer would be yes. The other thing I would say, again, I wouldn't want to quantify it, but I would encourage us to think this way, is that more of Boston are feeling increasingly comfortable at the museum. You know, the museum is a pretty intimidating place. It's got those big steps and it's got the formidable facade. But I think you're also seeing people feel more comfortable here, the sense that they do belong here. And I think the combination of expressing a desire to do that, creating protocols with wonderful staff who greet our public with a sense of welcome. I mean, those incremental things are, I think, building some momentum for us.
And I do want to talk about the financial hardship. You said in one interview that you were losing upwards of $200,000 a week in this second closure. You've been closed down twice. Could you handle a third closure if it happened? And what do you need from the greater Boston community to continue to bring this art to everyone?
Well, two answers maybe. One is, you know, another closure would be very, very hard on us. And, you know, we're in a serious situation as it is, pairing to essentials, keeping our staff first and foremost in our minds. So it's challenging, and we're going to do all we can to build our revenues. We're doing a lot online. We're doing some really interesting things in the retail space. You asked what Bostonians can do. Philanthropy is going well. There are a lot of calls on a lot of folks, but philanthropy really does make a difference in this moment, and a subset of philanthropy is membership. And, you know, I would urge people, whether it's for the Museum of Fine Arts or other arts organizations that they care about, to consider renewing their membership, beginning a membership. First of all, you have a stronger sense of belonging. Secondly, you're going to help institutions in your community survive or thrive. And that has such ripple effects in our education system, in our tourism profile, in our ability for companies to bring good workers into our community. You know, the support for public institutions is really important. So if you're asking me what could people do, visit your museums. Become members of your museums.
In our remaining time, what is the top thing you've learned navigating the MFA through this pandemic?
You know, I don't know that I've learned anything absolutely new. Sure, I have, if I really deep. But what I would say is that I've learned even more deeply. I've been reminded even more deeply, you don't do anything alone. You do it by working with others, by sharing your authority, by moving together, by keeping in mind what your values are and what your commitments are, and encouraging as many people as you can to move on that journey with you. That I've been, if I haven't learned it for the first time, I've certainly felt that more deeply than ever before.
And that is Matthew Teitelbaum, director of the Museum of Fine Arts. They reopened today after a second closing due to pandemic restrictions. Matthew, thanks for being with us. Good luck with the reopening.
Thanks. I'll see you at the MFA soon, I hope.
All right, stay with us. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we want you to call. Have you hit the pandemic wall? Tell us how this stress is weighing on you, how you're coping with it, maybe not coping with it. Tell us your pandemic wall story, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. All right, we are coming up on a year since our lives were completely upended by the pandemic. In that time, we have constantly adjusted to new normal and then another new normal and another new normal. In the beginning, we weren't scrambling to, let's say, keep a job, stay connected to distance learning, care for sick family members. We were doing coping things like baking bread, so much bread, maybe picking up new hobbies. And then the weather warmed up. We found ways to stay socially distant, maybe see each other outside. And then the buzz of the election, the holidays, the inauguration, they were different, but many of us found creative ways to celebrate or commemorate, usually without a crowd. But now we are in the dead of winter. It is February. There is nowhere to go. Stresses are piling up. We are between a vaccine and a hard place. And now, frankly, it is just like...
And make the pizza dough from scratch and make the meatballs. And I was making pasta with the kids and like totally living my best pandemic life. But like now, I don't want to make pizza dough right now. That started out being like, this is cool. We're starting traditions. This is stability. Now I'm like, oh my God.
That is comedian and MC Bethany Van Delft describing to us what many people are feeling right now. Are you? We want to talk with you about it. Have you hit a pandemic wall? I have. Over this pandemic, even though it's far from over, tell us your story. And what were you doing in the beginning to try to maintain some routine or stability that's just gone out the window? 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Two guests joining us for the conversation today with a good mix, I think, of serious and sense of humor. We have Tito Jackson, former Boston City Councilor and CEO of Verdant Medical, a cannabis company, and Megan Kelly, who is a social media editor for WBUR. Tito, Megan, welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Hi, Tiziana. It's so nice to talk to you.
Tiziana, it's great to have you both. Yeah, I hear you. So, Tito, have you hit the pandemic wall and are you eating your way through it? I am. How you doing?
I posted something the other day that said in the beginning of the pandemic, I wanted to lose 10 pounds and I'm only 15 pounds away. And so, you know, definitely the jigsaw puzzles and also organizing all of the drawers and, you know, throwing out stuff has been a bunch of, you know, projects that I've done. But, you know, you definitely do hit a wall. I think the social piece is absolutely critical. And I have a group of friends that we do a regular Zoom, which kind of allows us to connect with each other. And we've now added some adult beverages to that Zoom.
There you go. Megan, have you hit a wall?
I feel like I have hit so many walls. So I have two kids who are in school. They're in, I have a sixth grader and a third grader. And so it's been really difficult from the start. In fact, I chuckled to myself a little when you mentioned about people baking bread because I felt like I could not even bake bread. Like, I think I tweeted something like, I'm watching everyone on Instagram bake bread and I'm just in the corner trying to eat the Chinese food leftovers while my kids are crying about this or that. I feel like it comes and it goes, right? Like there are days where I feel like, okay, you know, there are nice things about being home, right? Like I'm spending more time with my kids and my husband than I ever have before. And there are other days where I'm like, if I don't leave this house for anything today, I'm going to lose my mind and maybe just open a window and scream because that's, you know, you get to that point.
And we, Tito, I think people have to open the window and scream. I mean, we are getting to that point and we haven't even added in. Tito, you were sick at one point and people have lost loved ones and they've lost jobs. I mean, at what point do you just open the window and scream?
Yeah, you know, that I feel very grateful to, one, be here, but also let's also acknowledge the fact that a lot of folks not only have passed from COVID, but then there are individuals who have long-term symptoms and sometimes irreparable issues that simply don't go away. I have a friend who's the same age as I am. I'm 45, went to high school, and she now has kidney disease, and it actually changed her vision. And so I think that that this component, the compelling aspects of this, thinking about one vaccine and all that stuff right now, but also really wanting people to not get this disease state is a real critical piece. And the fact that a lot of people are also suffering from anxiety and other mental health issues that we've seen a lot, including our children who are not currently in school in most districts. So there's some real thoughtful things that we need to begin to think about. And we don't have an answer right now. And also, we can't necessarily go back to norms that didn't work before.
Listeners, have you hit the pandemic wall? It may be painful. It may be funny. I usually find it's both. You got to laugh your way out of the crying. Let us be the community today. Tito Jackson's here. Megan Kelly's here. Call in. Share your story. Share your coping mechanisms. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's go to Leora in West Roxbury.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead, Leora.
Oh, hi. Well, I had a baby in August. I have a terminally ill parent in another country, and I feel like I held it together until my five-year-old had a snow day this week, and that just kind of put me over the edge because we're managing, but my husband doesn't get a snow day from work, so being home with both kids, I just felt like my head was hitting that pandemic wall real hard.
How are
you
today?
Yeah, that sounds – oh, I'm sorry, Tuzia.
Go, no, Megan, jump in.
I was just going to say, I think that sounds so hard, and I'm very congratulations on the baby, and I'm so sorry about your parent. I think that, it, you know, you're a mom too. You feel like maybe you have all the plates spinning or you have the cards stacked up, right? And all it takes is just one more little thing, and then the whole thing falls down. So
that sounds really difficult. And my industry is shut down, so I've become a stay-at-home parent, even though that was never the plan.
Yeah. And very sorry. We'll definitely be praying for your parent. But this transition, you know, we have a hospitality industry in the state of Massachusetts that has collapsed. And, you know, really beginning to think about in the future, in the very near future, what do people do? How are people going to cope? In addition to the fact that we have several tens of thousands of people who haven't paid rent since last year. A couple months from now. So there's a lot that we have to think about from a policy perspective and how we actually help folks get on into the future.
So, Megan Kelly, you responded immediately to Leora there, and I'm going to go back to the phones in a minute, but what are you doing to cope? Obviously, we're not baking bread anymore. What are you doing to cope on the tough days now?
Yeah, it's hard. I do want to make sure that everyone listening knows that, you know, I do feel incredibly lucky. I've been able to stay employed. My husband's been able to stay employed. We're very lucky. Neither of us have gotten sick and we can work from home, and our bosses have been incredibly understanding and wonderful. It's very hard for a lot of people out there. So I do try to count my blessings, like as my mom says, because that does sometimes kind of ground me back in reality. I think honestly, the biggest thing for me sometimes is just finding the little joys in things. I love eavesdropping on my kids' Zoom calls or Google Meets with their classes because you get a glimpse into their school day that maybe I definitely wouldn't have gotten before. And their teachers are killing it. Like, they are just working so hard. They are always upbeat. They're super positive about it. So that has been really nice, actually, is just hearing them talk to the kids pretty openly about stuff, but also just being honest that sometimes it's hard and, hey, everyone, let's take a break, and everyone, you can show off your pets or your baby brother or whatever. And, you know, there's stuff that is easy to do, like take a bath, but, or, you know, take a nice bracing walk. But honestly, sometimes, you know, I don't know, I'd want to go out for a bracing walk today. It's pretty cold, but, you know, I think it's important to find, even if it's just small things that they don't feel really big, but maybe are big, is a really big thing for me. And I hope for other people as well.
Yeah. Let's go back to the phones. Go ahead.
I also want to acknowledge that in these crisis situations, there are people who stepped up to do amazing things. And I know Monica Cannon Grant has been on the show multiple times, but she fed 80. She's a mom of six, and fed 80,000 people throughout this time. You have individuals in the community like the Boston Black COVID organization. You have a friend of mine, Frank Farrell, who's been doing stuff. So there's also this amazing phenomena of people who've actually been able, based on some of the needs that are out there, to have stepped up and done amazing work in this time. And this in no way, takes away from the amazing work that is happening in households like my colleague on the line right now, and just keeping it together on that day-to-day basis.
Yeah, and I think that's been a really nice like side effect of this is people are helping other people so much. And it's I covered something that Monica Cannon Grant was speaking at and was I didn't know she had six children. And like in the best of times, that impresses me. But in this time when she's able to help so many people is incredibly impressive.
Yeah, we actually had Monica's a local Boston activist. We actually had her on the show just a couple of weeks ago, just because our listeners might recognize that name. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Shanita's on the line from Grafton. Shanita, have you hit the wall?
Yes, I hit it a lot of times all through the year. It's been a roller coaster, but I think with the resources, my family, my friends, try to climb it a little bit, fallen down, climbed up again. I did sewing and painting and coloring, and everything I could think of, origami, it's really more difficult than you think. And every now and then I lose hope. I'm very excited about the vaccine. And I was listening earlier, and the director for MGH said that this year they had one-third of the patients. I'm hoping that next year is one-third of that. I still imagine of the really good times, and I want to be positive.
Shanita, what's the best origami shape you've learned to make?
A little bunny.
I love it. A little bunny. I want to see a picture of that.
Yeah,
so,
really...
Tito, go ahead. Megan, jump in.
No, I was just going to say that was impressive. Origami is very hard.
It is very hard.
Sorry.
I think I can do like a star. So Tito, how about you? Hobbies, you know, we already talked about Zoom and adult beverages. What else are you doing? And any funny stories of hitting the wall?
I've actually been taking some investment classes online. I wasn't up to snuff on all the GameStop stuff that happened. But, you know, I've actually taken a lot of time to reconnect individually with friends. One of the weird things about Facebook and the like, we think we know about folk, but we don't really. And just because most people post their best life on the internet, but when it comes down to actually doing this really radical thing, like making a actual phone call to somebody, and having, you know, an hour-long conversation, I've actually just kind of taken some time to do that in addition to, as you know, building a cannabis business. But that has been – those have been some of the highlights. And I got to spend a month with my mom in Florida. And I haven't gotten to spend that much time with my mom in a long time. And to be there, she had some medical procedures. And to be there and just to be still – and, you know, just have her back. That has been one of the other things from a quote-unquote side effect side, to slow down a little bit, to appreciate this thing that we call life and the amazing family and friends that I have.
That sounds really nice.
Let's go. It does. Megan, have you been able to see parents? Are your parents still with you, and have you been able to see them?
Yeah, my parents actually live on Martha's Vineyard, so we have seen them. We did visit them over the summer, and then they've been helping out one of my sisters who had a third son in May. So they've been helping, my mom's been helping out with the little one. So sometimes she'll stop by and we'll, you know, we'll say hi or we'll just kind of do stuff. We have a screened in porch that we can kind of chat in and feel a little safer with the mask on about saying hello. But, you know, we didn't spend Christmas with them, and I was really sad about it, but it felt like the right thing to do. But yeah. I've spent every Christmas of my life with my parents, so it felt a little strange and a little sad.
Yeah. Let's go back to the phones. 800-423-8255. We've got Michelle on the line from Marblehead. Hi, Michelle.
Hey, how are you doing? Long time listener, first time caller.
Jump on in, Michelle. Glad you called.
Sure. So I'm a nanny, and for the pandemic, you know, I was just kind of going with the flow, but I was a little bit excited because I was, you know, going to be able to have that opportunity to do homeschooling and then kind of learning about the differences between remote learning and homeschooling. And, March kicked in and you know, I was planning crafts almost on the daily. I'm a live-in. That waned a little bit during the summer. I was still doing crafts, and now, you know, being that, you know, it's coming on a year, a lot of that slowed down. I think I think I ran out of the craft. I had taken advantage of one of those craft stores closing, so I bought a ton of stuff, and I thought I was going to be able to, like, get it through past the summer. And I'm a no screen TV nanny, so I'm always offering activities and such. And we ran out of crafts, so we were able to do a lot of outside activities during the summer, and then now we've hit the summer months, and yeah. You know, it's tough for the kids because they can't socialize, and it's tough for nannies too in general, not even just live-ins, because you know, we're in isolation, and then also, too, a lot of families are demanding, COVID guidelines where they don't want you, you know, socializing outside of the house. My family's not like that.
Michelle.
I have some underlying issues, too, so, you know, I've been stripped with COVID as well.
So we're going to take it back from you there, Michelle. Thanks. And I do want to say that Michelle's I have run out of crafts is my new metaphor for the moment that we're in this pandemic. Megan, Tito, have you run out of crafts? Are we? Let me just tell you guys, the other day I lost my car keys for a very short period of time, and I lost my mind in a way that was truly disproportionate to the loss of the car keys, because I was like, I don't go anywhere. So how can I have lost my car keys? I mean, I'm kind of out of crafts, you guys.
Yeah, I mean, that has definitely happened to me, that it was something very small. Like, I think I dropped a glass one day and it broke. And I just was like, I can't do anything. I can't even put my glasses away in the cupboard. What is life? kind of thing. I'm definitely out of crafts. I love that.
Yeah. I actually, one funny thing that happened to me was in September of last year, I got a call from my dry cleaner, and he said, Tito, you need to come get your dry cleaning from March. And I literally realized that I had all of these suits that were in the dry cleaner. And I didn't miss them because I had no reason to, And then I my favorite new hobby is using the snowblower that I got. I have done, I did like four or five of my neighbor's driveways, and I think it speaks to the level of boredom that the new snowblower that I have is like my new favorite best friend.
Yeah, if you're excited to be running the snowblower in a snowstorm for multiple houses, Tito, yes, you have hit the wall. All right, I want to grab one more call here, and then I'm probably going to have to say goodbye to everybody. Let's grab Katie in Chatham. Katie, briefly.
My fiance and I, we're both retired, and being trapped on Cape Cod is actually a wonderful thing to do, but we generally travel the world so much. But right here, having nowhere to go, we became foster parents, and 3 weeks ago, our lives got flipped upside down with a beautiful five-year-old, and that's our COVID response.
Katie, that is beautiful. So in our last, you know, minute each, Tito and Megan, service is a wonderful way to break through that wall. What's one act of service that you might have people think about? Tito, you first, briefly.
I think there's right now one of the most important pieces is people speaking about the vaccine and educating individuals about the vaccine. One of the disparities that I've seen is something that one of my friends, Thaddeus Miles, who often posts online, who runs a Black Joy hashtag, and 50% of the people who've gotten the vaccine are white, 11% are Black. And so there's a huge disparity racially in terms of people who are actually getting the vaccine, and that will translate into people living or dying. And I think one of the most important service pieces that we can do is make sure that we educate folks about the life-saving vaccine that's out there and push through the noise and make sure that people's lives are saved.
Thanks for that reminder. Megan, 30 seconds or so. One thing for service.
I would say introduce yourself to your neighbors if you haven't already. I have lived in my house for 8 years and knew some of my neighbors, but now I know almost all of them. And it has been wonderful to meet new people and to talk to people in all different stages of life. And so I know that we can be kind of like a frosty city, but I think that it would do you good to meet your neighbors, you know, look out for each other, collect each other's mail, you know, look, know who's has what dog kind of thing. And I think that reaching out to people to see how you can help them is going to help you feel better.
That is Megan Kelly, who is a social media editor at WBUR, and Tito Jackson, former Boston City Councilor and CEO of Verdant Medical, a cannabis company. Paris Alston wants me to remind you both, or everyone, you guys have celebrity names, and we're taking all the wins. So thank you for bringing your celebrity vibe to the show today. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
We say a bittersweet goodbye to producer Zoe Mitchell, who's leaving the show after 4 years for her next adventure. As producer Walt Wuthman puts it, Zoe is a force of nature. He notes that we have all enjoyed moments when guests have called it Zoe's show. Chris Siderick says she is everything you could want in a teammate, including a relentless force as a producer and a ferocious ally for her colleagues. Paris Alston compared Zoe to Jane Lynch with a Lady Gaga charm, and that was just too good. So Jamie Bologna, who notes that he's going to miss Zoe's energy, warmth, sparkle, and talent, pulled this from an interview Zoe did with Jane Lynch in 2019.
You know, I was a big fan of Glee. I was a stage manager, musical theater kid, more than a performer.
Of course you were. I can tell by looking at you.
But 1 year for Halloween, I dressed up like Sue Sylvester. This is like 2010.
Oh, isn't that great? That's wonderful. You look fantastic.
Isn't that hysterical?
Yeah, I'm honored. It's great.
When he formally hired Zoe in 2018 after her internship, our executive producer, Hitesh Hathi, declared, "The first win on this primary day goes to Radio Boston." Well, Zoe, you have been a win for us every day since. I and we cannot wait to see what you will do next in the world. Godspeed. We will miss you.